Welcome to Fusion, a show for Relay FM members where I talk to hosts from various shows about a single topic. My name is Stephen Hackett, and this month I'm joined by Micah Sargent of Clockwise and Jason Snell of Six Colors and Upgrade to talk through Apple's year. Hey guys.
Hello.
How's everybody here at the very end of the year?
Doing well. It's festive times, and so I'm wearing a Santa hat shirt today, I'm not currently wearing the Santa hat, but I've got lots of twinkly lights around me, so I'm in the festive mood and feeling good.
That's exciting. What about you, Jason?
Trying to think about, like, are there any lists of predictions or best of the years or things that I've left unattended that I need to get to before it turns into 2019 and all that. And, as we record this, kind of finishing up all of my stuff that I'm trying to do in advance of the holiday season so that I can then kind of have a couple of weeks that are a little bit lighter.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have at least one more list because I thought it'd be fun to sort of round robin some good things in Apple's year and some bad things. So we do this on Connected a lot, where the three of us kind of go through and make our picks, and we sort of cycle through. So let's start with the good. Jason, what is on the top of your good list?
The iPad Pro is in the top of my good list. Like, as an iPad user, I was so happy to finally get a new version of the iPad Pro and have it be so dramatically improved over the last, generation with the Face ID stuff and USB-C and the upgraded hardware. And, I want the iOS software to be better, but the hardware, I love it quite a lot. I'm very happy with it. That was my favorite thing that Apple released this year. So I'm excited. I'm just gonna say iPad Pro makes me happy.
I'm jealous. I've not made that upgrade yet. I'm on the iPhone. I'm on the iPad 10.5 inch Pro. and I like that one. I'm still eyeballing the new one, and everybody, sharing their photos of the new. It makes me want it. So probably in the new year, that's gonna find its way into my hands. Ugh. Now I do have a question here. How does a round robin compare to a draft? Like, how am I supposed to say my pick now, or are we all supposed to go around and say how we feel about Jason's pick?
I think we could do there. I think we could do either. I like Jason's pick. The hardware is so much nicer than what it was before. It really feels like Apple has stepped into a new era of industrial design, and I would love if the new iPhones in 2019 or 2020 kind of look like this. I'm sort of tired of like the soap, bar of soap type feel with the rounded edges. I like the hard edges of this thing, and I hope it goes everywhere.
That's one of my favorite things about it, because it reminds me of iPhones of yesteryear. Some of those are my favorite designs, that candy bar feel, as it were. And yeah, those nice sharp edges were, I don't know, I was more likely to go caseless back in the day than I am now, because those slick edges make it very difficult to grip. And so having that flat edge, I think, kind of adds a little bit of friction. But also, I don't know, there's something about it just looks nicer to me. And one of the things about the MacBook Pro that I always enjoyed over some of Apple's other models of laptop was that it also had that completely uniform look versus like the MacBook Air, which had that what I felt was a disgusting tapered look to it. And so I like this very it looks like it was precision engineered in a way that I don't get that same feeling with the iPhones and other devices that have that sort of rounded edge.
So what about you, Micah? What do you bring to the table?
My first good this year is the Series 4 Apple Watch and the just recently released ECG functionality. I had been on a Series 0 Apple Watch for quite some time. I didn't upgrade to Series 1, and I didn't upgrade to Series 2. And then I ran into some health scares that landed me in the emergency room because of some stuff going on with my heart. And it was a scary time trying to figure out what was going on there. And I sort of wanted to have a way to better monitor my heart and make sure that, you know, when I wasn't walking around with one of those multi-lead ECG monitors for a week, that I could still have some sort of information about my heart rate. And so I upgraded to the Series 3 Apple Watch, and I was really happy with that one. I was happy with the improved heart rate tracking functionality and the things that came with that, as well as all the great things that come with a newer watch: faster, better connection, all that kind of stuff. And then they announced the Series 4 Apple Watch, and they announced that it was going to have this built-in ECG, single-lead ECG feature, and it was going to be even better at doing this sort of health heart tracking stuff. And I said, well, gonna have to have that one, I guess. So I, you know, made the upgrade to the Series 4, and as I said, the reason I was purchasing it was because of the health stuff. But when I got it and, you know, saw it on my wrist, suddenly it was so much more than that. If you look online and you see the differences between the Series 3 and Series 4 for measurements of like the screen size, it's all very tiny numbers that don't really do a good job of translating exactly what's going on. But when you put the watch on your wrist and you look at it, that screen is like gigantic in comparison, it feels. And I remember putting it on my wrist and going to type in the passcode and seeing that each of the number keys was so much bigger. And I thought, oh, wow, this is a pretty cool watch. And I have very much enjoyed this watch, and have enjoyed now the addition of that ECG feature. Within like 24 hours of it being released to the public, there was a Reddit thread that got picked up by, you know, several outlets talking about a guy or a person who had gone to the doctor, and the doctor was like, hey, you might want to buy stock in Apple because this watch probably just saved your life because of spotting an arrhythmia and needing to go to a cardiologist and get all of that figured out. And I really like that. You know, there's a part of me that can be a little cynical about, yes, they're, you know, searching out these stories of these feel good moments, so everybody will want to buy these watches. But I've lost some of that cynicism, because I think that in any case, saving someone's life or improving someone's life is a good thing. And if there are different motivations behind it, it's not about the, you know, the motivation, it's about the impact. And I'm glad that people are helped, and I certainly feel empowered by having this device and being able to better understand what's going on with my ticker. So very good for Apple in terms of Apple Watch health and heart.
Yeah, it feels like to me the Series 4, it kind of reminds me of the iPhone 4. It's like you see it, it's like, okay, this is what they wanted to build, right? It's not that it's that much thinner than the ones before it, because it's not, but it seems to sit better on the wrist, kind of sit lower on the wrist, and the larger screen with the smaller edges in there, it just feels a lot nicer than previous watches. It's one of those product releases that you see the old one, you're just like, ooh, that's kind of weird. why is it so weird?
Yes.
But the new one really is nice, and I really am appreciative that Apple kept the band compatibility between the generations, because I don't know about y'all, but I've got a handful of them. You know, yeah. I haven't gone the full Rene Ritchie on it, but I've got several, and it would have been a bummer to see those go by the wayside. So I appreciate that Apple worked to keep those things compatible. That's a nice nod to people who, you know, have worn this thing for many years and are upgrading yet again.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've been collecting the Pride bands since they came out, and I'd be sad if I couldn't, you know, continue to use those ones that I'd already collected. And just the idea that, you know, whenever the watch first shipped all those years ago, back in my day, it was pretty the sort of conversation was about, well, how are people going to be convinced to upgrade to the next watch? And are we going to be like switching out internal packages? Like, how's this going to work? And I think that it's pretty cool that four series down the line, you can keep these bands that probably, if you, you know, added up all the cost, you would not be too happy that you spent that much money on said bands. And so it's nice that I can still use my 44 millimeter watch bands on my, what is it, 42? Whatever. Anyway, the numbers don't matter. The bigger size.
The big one. And yeah, I agree. I the Series 4 is a really great upgrade. The bigger screen is amazing. The ECG thing is just, you know, Apple thinks that there's something there in terms of more and more health features, not just, you know, fitness features, but health features, and having a health monitor attached to your body at all times can warn you and also inform your doctor. And I think they're right. I think that it's early days yet, but I think it's an exciting place that is going to ultimately improve people's health and save lives, which is a pretty cool way to change the world with a tech product.
So I'm up next, and I am going the software route just to be a little bit different. There's something new in there. And that is the promise of iOS apps on the Mac. I'm not talking about the specific reality of them quite yet, but the idea that the Mac ecosystem is right on the brink of a big change. And, you know, I'm excited about it. I'm excited about having apps like Ferrite, Jason's beloved audio editor. I'm excited about having that on the Mac, potentially. I'm excited about having things like Overcast or, you know, these iOS apps that are kind of stranded on iOS that I can't use when I'm at my iMac Pro, because that's where I am most of the day. And I think it's going to breathe new life into macOS in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. And there's going to be growing pains and awkwardness, which we can talk about later, but I'm choosing to be optimistic that this is going to really be good for the Mac as a platform.
I agree. I know that right now things aren't great because there are these sort of test apps, but I think that there are plenty of apps that I use on my iPad and iPhone on the daily that I just, oh man, it'd be so nice if I could just pop that up on my Mac, especially when it comes to like photo editing and things like that. I would just love to drag and drop a photo into this app and make my changes to it and move on.
Current apps are bad, but at least they provide needed functionality, but they're not good. I want to believe that there is a larger story that is going to be told in 2019 that isn't just sort of better marzipan stuff, but also a bigger picture where Apple has a new vision for how developers are going to build apps, leveraging iOS, how iOS apps are built, but bigger than that, that goes across all of Apple's platforms and that is maybe more cohesive and makes iOS apps, makes iPad apps feel more functional and also brings those apps to the Mac. I think it can benefit Mac users and iPad users both.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to do one more round of good. Jason, you're up.
There's not a draft, but I'm going to mention that I am using HomeKit. Like, that's a big thing for me this year, is that I originally bought the smart home devices I did buy were not HomeKit compatible. It was too early for the HomeKit stuff. And so I had like some Wemo switches and some other stuff. But now I've got, you know, almost everything I've got does HomeKit. And then I also run HomeBridge, which is the little command line utility that runs on my Mac Mini that it bridges all my non-compatible stuff and makes it HomeKit compatible. And you put all that together, and now I'm using the Home app all the time. I've got schedules in HomeKit. The whole thing is in there. I can see my Nest thermostat, even though it's not HomeKit compatible. It's in there because of HomeBridge. I got a couple of smart outlets that I put in to replace my old, smart light switches, so that I don't have to put in smart bulbs necessarily, just smart switches that turn the bulbs on and off or dim them. And it's all been great. And I think I'm becoming more excited about the promise of smart home stuff and HomeKit stuff after it just has taken a while. But I feel like we're slowly emerging from the really janky early days, and it's more together than it's been before. And the big moment that I have not, this is an exclusive to this podcast, I have not mentioned this anywhere else on any other podcast I've been on. We bought a smart lock, and that I installed earlier this week. And so now my front door is on HomeKit, but it's actually been pretty great, and has solved a bunch of issues that we had with our old deadbolt lock. So, I guess I'm all in on HomeKit, and I'm surprised because I was a HomeKit skeptic not too long ago.
That makes me so happy. So I've talked, I probably bring this up way too often, but one of the things that's been frustrating for me as a HomeKit wizard is hearing the ongoing narrative that HomeKit quote sucks, unquote, because at the beginning when it was first announced, heavens yes, it was not great. There were lots of problems with it in and of itself, and then there weren't very many devices that could work with HomeKit. And so those things added up to a pretty crummy experience. However, over time, things have vastly improved, and HomeKit has added a lot more features. Apple has improved the way that devices communicate with each other. Apple has added more devices that can communicate with each other within your home, and then while you're out of your home, the third-party companies that are creating these HomeKit-enabled devices are also improving their Bluetooth communication so that they talk more often to each other, and that devices can sort of relay off of each other. There's all this really awesome stuff that's going on behind the scenes that doesn't necessarily get attention. And there are people who heard in the beginning, HomeKit sucks, and then they've not given it a chance. They've not tried it since then, and they continue that narrative. And so every time I hear that, I'm like, have you tried it in the past, like, I don't know, several months? Because it's actually gotten pretty great. I've used to run Homebridge because I had some devices that were outside of the HomeKit scope, but I ended up just sort of going all in on HomeKit. And so my garage door, my front door smart lock, all the lights in my house, like I've got it all pretty much HomeKitted. And that is why I was very happy about the Home app coming to the Mac, because that was an app that I use very often and quite frequently in my phone, and wanted to be able to do from my computer as well. So yeah, every time I hear somebody talking, you know, getting excited about it, especially people, you know, who have lots of eyes, as Jason does, talking about HomeKit and being excited about it makes me happy, because it's like, now the folks who maybe still think that HomeKit isn't great will see, oh wow, this could actually be very helpful and useful, and can be fun as well, because I think it's a lot of fun.
It feels like it's come a long way since it rolled out. You know, sometimes Apple does this with new technology, like, hey, there's this new thing, and like three people are using it. And sometimes that goes the way of the iPad smart connector, where like it doesn't go anywhere. But then other times, over time, something like HomeKit can really blossom into a really rich ecosystem that can prove out to actually be like really helpful in everyday life. And that's a fun route when things go that way.
Agreed. And speaking of HomeKit and improving and blossoming, when Apple launched iOS 11.3, one of the features that didn't make the bullet point list of the update in everyone's phone was a new method for software authentication, so that folks who create smart home devices no longer have to use hardware-based authentication to be able to market their products as works with Apple HomeKit, and also can update the firmware of products that are already on the market to work with HomeKit as well. So for the longest time, there were lots of stories out there that talked about how Apple made it very, whereas Amazon was like, hey, we're just going to set up, you know, this cloud server, and all you got to do is just write a few lines of code, and then you can connect with everybody you want to, and the Amazon device will be able to communicate with all of your smart home stuff. Apple was pushing for local network control and far more far more robust encryption and authentication. And so that meant that all the sessions were end-to-end encrypted. They were also mutually authenticated. There were all of these different things, and like encryption keys wouldn't be reused, all this stuff. That is still a factor that still plays into it. But in the past, the only way that you could go about doing this was if you included, as a third-party manufacturer of a smart home device, if you included a little chip inside that was the authentication coprocessor, and that was required in order to obtain the HomeKit certification. There are multiple reasons other than just the fact that this allowed you to be HomeKit compatible. It was also a lot easier at the time to basically put in a chip and then, you know, set everything up so that the chip could take care of all of that end-to-end encryption, yada, 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 and still be a low-powered device. So for folks who are making Bluetooth-enabled devices, that was particularly helpful. But there were companies out there who already had products on the market, like Belkin and their very popular Waymo stuff. Because of that, they, you know, they'd have to go back to the drawing board and create a new board to include that coprocessor inside. Well, they obviously didn't want to do that. And so Apple said, all right, we are going to allow folks to be able to do software authentication instead. All the same things are in place, but companies don't have to have that coprocessor. And the interesting thing, when I was, you know, doing a lot of research for this, one of the things that kind of came out was that there are still going to be a lot of companies that take the authentication coprocessor route because it's not easy to pull off all of that software-based authentication. But companies that can, like Waymo, it's okay for them to do so. And that is why you this year would have seen, you know, firmware updates for those products to give you access. It's weird, though, because they released a bridge that gave HomeKit compatibility, and then shortly after that added this option to just be able to use it with HomeKit without needing the bridge.
That's surprise.
Yeah. So it's awesome. More access for more people, and less complaints about it not being overall system.
I'm going to round out the good with the return of the big phone in the iPhone XS Max. So I was a member of the Plus Club for the entire run, and I went through the iPhone X, you know, for a year, and I really liked the iPhone X, but several times I had wished for something larger. It just felt a little bit cramped coming from the Plus phones, and Apple gave me what I wanted. Actually gave me two options, the XR and the XS Max. But you know, the XS Max may be the best phone that I've used. You know, I've got phones that I preferred the look and feel of. You know, we mentioned the flat sides of like the iPhone 4, 4S, 5, and 5S. But the XS Max, if you like the big phones, then it is really, really great. The XR may edge it out on battery life because of that. The differences in the technology in it, but the dual cameras, the good speakers, the giant screen, and something that's still pretty thin is something that I'm really enjoying months into it.
Agreed. Steven, you've commented before on my monster hands. The XS Max fits perfectly in my monster hands, and I really enjoy it.
I just don't understand you guys, but that's fine.
That's fine.
I'm glad there's a thing that you like.
It takes all types, Jason. All types.
More little phones from little-ish, little asterisk phones for me. Yay!
I was going to say, yeah, because the XS is tiny. So now we turn to the less good things, the things that in 2018 left us scratching our heads or with a sour taste in our mouths here at the end of the year. Jason?
The price of Apple's laptops continues to make me unhappy. The MacBook Air, as much as the Retina MacBook Air is an impressive system that feels like it's finally the system I can more broadly recommend to people when they say I want to buy a new Mac laptop, maybe for my kid who's going off to school or something, I can say the MacBook Air instead of being like, well, there's the MacBook, but then there's the MacBook Pro without the touch bar. Now I can just say the MacBook Air. That's great. It costs too much. I think, you know, just from my opinion, I am really disappointed that Apple doesn't offer that model at a base price of $999. Now, look, they could decontent it like Microsoft did with its Surface laptop and make the $999 one not a laptop anybody wants in terms of storage and memory and all of those things, and then have the bulk of them be $1,199. But I really wanted Apple to say, we've got a laptop for $999 with Retina. And instead what they said is, you can still buy the old MacBook Air for $999, which I don't like it. I don't like the costs across the board, but I think the pricing on Apple's laptops is the most difficult. And what I'm concerned about is that Apple is now starting to view the Mac as a niche market to extract money from. The idea there is that if you're using the Mac, you are so connected to being a computer user and a Mac user in this, our mobile device era, that you're going to be willing to pay even more in order to stay on those devices. And I don't like that either. So that's the thing I'm disappointed by. I felt like they had a real opportunity to push something at $999 as a Retina laptop, and they didn't, you know. And again, the MacBook Air is the cheapest Retina laptop ever. It's still $200 shy of hitting that goal, and it disappoints me.
I couldn't agree more.
I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Thank you.
I think you're totally right, man. It's not only that it's too high, but Apple didn't fix the confusion. You know, the problem that I talk about is if you have like $1,300 in your pocket to buy a laptop, it's actually more confusing now than it was before the Air showed up. And it's just, it's really frustrating. I hope they can bring that Air down in price and get rid of the old one. But I guess time will tell.
Time will tell. My first bad is an interesting thing that happened this year where every year people typically after an Apple event will run to the site and look for the details and see what's changed. And there was an interesting thing this year where Apple was not including as many things in the box. And so lots of iPhones no longer include the lightning to headphone jack adapter, which some people really, really, really want, apparently, because people were very upset about that. You can buy it separately, but it was no longer included in the box. And that was sort of a message about what Apple sees as as the future there, I guess, of listening. And then also, only Apple Watch cellular models for certain series of Apple Watch, so older model Apple Watches, they do not have, only the cellular models have the 5-watt adapter with them. So that tiny little cube that you plug your wire into and then charge your Apple Watch, only if you bought an old model cellular version do you also get that little adapter in the box. Otherwise, hopefully you have one or you've got some other one. And yes, most people do, but still, that's sort of the idea that they can't include that in the box is kind of crummy. And Stephen, you noted too that there was another change.
Yeah, the current crop of MacBooks and MacBook Pros and everything don't come with the extension cable for the power adapter. So if you have a USB-C charging notebook, you just get the duck head, which is like the little, in the States at least, the little two-prong flippy-out guy. And if you want to put that on a longer power cable, they used to come in the box, and now that's separate, and which just really feels like a slap. It's like, come on. They sell it for like...
I didn't know that one. God.
Like $10 or $15. Like, put it in the box. It's ridiculous.
I know that there are plenty of arguments and conversations about this is, you know, finding the right balance of price and yada yada yada, but my goodness, that company sure does make a whole lot of money. You'd think they could put
the
one
good
in
news,
box.
Stephen, is that those laptop prices they're passing the savings on to you. Oh no, they're not.
No, they're not. No, they're
not. Oh wait, they're more expensive.
Jason, you mentioned my first negative point a couple minutes ago. So I said I was excited about the promise of iOS apps on the Mac, but the reality of the first ones is real bad.
I see what you did
there. We have news and stocks, voice memos, and home. Home may be the most egregious. It uses a bunch of like iOS date pickers and stuff instead of the what we're going to see on the Mac, which like barely works with a mouse. Like, just good luck doing that. None of these things can spawn multiple windows. They struggle to open things in other apps. They're just really, they feel like ports, and they feel like bad ports. And some users may be okay with that, but I think the Mac faithful are going to have a real problem if these iOS apps that start washing up on our shores, you know, feel like they're from a different planet. They need to feel more native than they do. To your point, Jason, Apple hasn't really said much about how these apps are built. They sort of just like, oh, they're here, and, you know, sort of were hand-wavy about the technology behind them. And I hope that Apple has a more convincing story this time around for developers and for its own apps, because the reality is developers still, I still think this is true, look to Apple apps for like good defaults and like sort of the way things should be done. And Apple set that bar too low with these four apps they've brought over from iOS. And if they want these apps to be quality, they need to show that themselves. And I hope that they do.
I'm scared if I gripe about it, then the home app's going to disappear off of my Mac. So I'm just going to be quiet. I like being able to control things on my Mac, and yeah.
I'm very happy that the home app exists, and I understand why the news app exists on the Mac, because those are strategic things for Apple. They're not very good. I'm glad. So, you know, obviously there was a moment where they had that conversation, which was, do we want to have these apps? Which is more important, that these apps be on the Mac, or that these apps only come to the Mac when they're good? And they chose for them to exist, and that's okay, but I do, it does make me worry a little bit about what Apple's standards are for the forthcoming onslaught of iOS app conversions.
Yeah, oh boy. Oh boy. All right, Jason, what do you have?
Well, let's see. How about confusion about what exactly Apple is doing with its input devices? And this goes in a few different areas. The Touch Bar, I was hoping that in 2018 we'd get a clear signal about how Apple feels the Touch Bar is doing. Like, is it here to stay? Is it going away? There were no substantial improvements to Touch Bar in terms of software in Mojave. You can do all sorts of clever things with better touch tool, but in the stock format, like, they added the support for quick actions, but that's about it. It's still sort of basically what they did before. Individual apps can do cool things with them, but there's no, you know, really great system-wide thing. And even, I would say, even the quick actions thing is kind of half measure, in that if there are quick actions that are not available in the current context, they don't disappear. They just get grayed out, and you can only fit like three in there, or four maybe. So like, if you have eight and they all work with different things, you can't, it won't work. It just won't work. Because it doesn't make them go away when they're not available. It just shows them and they're not available. It's frustrating. And I figured, like, if they added touch bars to other models, or did an external touch bar keyboard or something like that, or if they did anything where they showed an investment on the software side, that would be a sign that the touch bar was here to stay. They didn't, but it didn't go away. So we're still in limbo with that. They didn't change the butterfly keyboard to a different kind. They updated it to make it better. It is, by most accounts, better. It is more reliable. It feels better. It doesn't sound as weird and crunchy as it used to. That's all good, but I'm still not convinced that in the long run that is the right keyboard for Apple's laptop line. And so we're in limbo there. And Touch ID, like, it's great that it's on the MacBook Air. I feel like Touch ID is a good technology for the Mac, but Face ID is where it's at on the iPhone and iPad now. And most Macs have, you know, laptops and iMacs have cameras. And the Face ID would seem, in the long run, especially on the iMac and external displays driven by a Mac Mini or a Mac Pro next year, that Face ID would be the right choice there. So I'm really not sure where they are with biometric authentication on the Mac as well. So I feel like we're in this kind of ravine between the old times and the new times, trying to find our way. And I just don't believe that what we've got now is going to stick, but we didn't get any sign about what is new. It was just another year down in the ravine.
And hopefully adding Face ID to the Mac means that Apple will finally have to improve the camera that they put into Macs, because those built-in webcams are 360p. No, I'm kidding.
Well, the MacBooks, I think, 480, so you're not far off. You know, the thing...
Yeah, I think the new Air has a decent webcam in it.
Yeah, I think that the depth of the lid is going to be the issue there, but Jason, you're absolutely right. Like, why is that not in the iMac Pro? I would hope that that's in the new external display they're working on. If it's not in the external display, then I'm going to be pretty disappointed, I think.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, I feel so sad now, but yeah, it's just like all this stuff needs to get addressed, but the external display really does, like, right? Because having Touch ID on an external keyboard that's only the Apple keyboard, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, for external displays and iMacs, they should all just go to Face ID.
All right, Micah, what's your last pick?
My final pick, and I have to be clear about this, Apple uses the word Siri for quite a few things. It's Siri intelligence and Siri shortcuts and Siri this, Siri that. When I'm talking about Siri, I'm specifically talking about the voice in the box, the virtual assistant that you communicate with and is supposed to help you out with things. Siri is still not great. Siri shortcuts are cool. Again, all that other fun stuff that is marked under Siri intelligence is pretty cool, but Siri, the voice person, is still not great. And I continue to see improvements from other virtual assistants, and especially I've seen some really interesting stuff from Amazon this year, including things like follow-up, where when questions aren't answered, then Alexa will follow up with you later and say, hey, I didn't have that answer before, but I do have that now. So if you ever need to ask this again, got it. The like hunches and things like that are built in, where it helps you do tests for, or rather where it starts to figure out how you use your smart home stuff. And then it can suggest, like, oh, Micah, I think you might want to turn off your light. Am I right? There are all these fun things and helpful things that I see other smart assistants doing. And I continue to just not use Siri for anything. One of the big reasons why I like the Home app and why I talk about the Home app so much is because I don't trust Siri to do any of those things for me. I have a bit of a control issue, and I know that if I ask Siri to do it, not only am I going to have to ask her or ask it six different questions. Hey, will you please turn off this light? Hey, will you please turn off this light? Hey, will you please turn off this light? But, it doesn't always get it right how I want it. And so I like to be able to have that control. And I just want to, you know, I know that Apple, the argument that's sort of made there about Siri is that Apple is working on a virtual assistant that's available in a bajillion languages and works, you know, all across the world. And because of that, it's sort of more spread out and not going to be able to lock into stuff. But I don't think that's, I get it, but I want it to be better.
I think everyone does.
You know, yeah, that's fair too.
I'm using it more than I did. Part of that is the home pods that keep populating my house. But there are definitely times where it just completely falls down. And then you can ask it again the same thing and then it's fine. Like, that sort of inconsistency is what bothers me more than anything, I think.
Yeah, I get that with my HomePods too, where sometimes it just loses the plot and it doesn't know what it's doing, or it plays something that's completely inappropriate. And I'm like, what are you doing, Siri? And, you know, there's just that thing that came out, the Loop Ventures thing that tested it, that said the Siri is improving faster than the others. But that's also because it had the longest amount of room to improve. So, you know, but, you know, I think they just made the guy... John Gianandrea, who's the head of like AI and stuff that they hired from Google, they just made him part of Apple's executive board or executive team. I feel like that is, you know, yet another sign that Apple gets that they need to be much, much better at this. And, you know, with any luck, these initial hopeful signs that Siri might be getting better. I agree, Micah. Like, the challenge is going to be after the bad impression Siri leaves, Apple's also going to need to convince people to try it again. So they need to make it a lot better and then give people a reason to give it a try again.
Yep. My last one is maybe a little bit off the beaten path, but one that really bothers me. I know, Jason, you've spoken about this too, is that Apple has no solution for photo management for families. So if you can have iCloud family sharing, so you share a pool of data, and you know everyone can do their iCloud photo libraries. But if you want to actually like fling images around to other people, you really have some pretty limited options. You've got shared photo albums, which I believe still downsize your images, which is really frustrating. You have AirDrop, which is can be flaky, and then you're just kind of like, "What did I send you those? Did I send you these?" And there's some sharing stuff on iOS 12, but this feels like a Band-Aid. What people want is, "Hey, let my spouse or significant other or partner see all of my albums, and you know, give me some simple controls over what I share and if it's read only or they can write to my library, but just let people be able to access it." Google Photos does this so well, and Apple is just behind the times. It's so, so frustrating.
I will speak about your Band-Aid for a moment, which is that actually is a pretty good feature, and it doesn't get this where it needs to be. But like, we were putting together our calendar for next year based on photos from this year, and this is the moment where my wife has to plug her phone into my iPad or my Mac so I can import her photos into my library. But if she's on iCloud Photo Library and it's deleted the photos, then they don't all show up for import, which is really bad. Like, it's this whole thing that is a mess. But that new feature on iOS 12 that lets you select photos and what you're and share them, and what you're sharing is an iCloud link. It's a good feature. It's not what you're asking for, which is the ability to say, you know what, when my wife takes pictures, they're in my library. We both agree we're sharing the same library, and it's not that. But what it is an iCloud link that goes to a web page if you're on a Mac that will actually let you either add them with one click to your iCloud photo library or download all of the original images to your Mac. And on an iPhone or an iPad, if you click on that link, it takes you into Photos and it says, would you like to put these in your iCloud photo library? And what's happening in the background, obviously, is that like those shared photos at full resolution are in this sort of buffer zone where they're out, where they're available to anybody with that link, but they're still, you know, it's the ones that are in iCloud Photo Library. So when I add them to my library, I don't download them. I just like one tap and suddenly all of her photos that she shared are in my library at full resolution. It's not good enough, but it's way better than the old way where you were sharing low resolution photos. So, you know, it is a Band-Aid, but I would say it's a pretty good Band-Aid. It does not solve the larger issue of especially a couple of married people, let's say, or other partners who are like, our lives are together. We share all our photos together. We want to share a library, and you just can't. And it's infuriating. But this is a nice, albeit manual, workaround that's way better than the old model, which was literally you just had to plug in the phone and import the photos.
Maybe we could just fax them to each other. That'll work.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Or just beam them to each other's brains.
Yeah, we'll beam them to each other's Palm Pilots with infrared.
Yes. I mean, infrared blaster will be set. I think that does it for this episode of Fusion. Thank you so much for supporting Relay FM and the shows that these guys are on. If you're not a member and you're hearing this, it's okay. We still love you, but you should go to relay.fm/membership and check out the shows that Micah and Jason are on. Pick one, support each month. That would be really swell. And until next month, adios.